Jeff Timmer is former executive director of the Michigan Republican Party. Mark Brewer is former chair of the Michigan Democrats. And this is a republic, if you can keep it, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
It's another week of A Republic, if you can keep it. I'm Mark Brewer. In a few minutes, Jeff Timmer and I will be joined by Dr. Tom Nichols, author of the New York Times bestseller, Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. First, Jeff, though, let's talk Michigan politics. Specifically, I'd really like to hear your take on Trump's endorsement now of two Republican candidates for statewide office next year. Kristen Caramo for Secretary of State and Matthew DiPerno for Attorney General. What do you think?
Well, it's been a recurring theme on this podcast and, you know, in my commentary that the Republican Party has gone completely and utterly batshit crazy. And nowhere is that more evident than in those who are delegates at conventions. They are it's kind of the pure, distilled, undistilled crazy of the party. The fundamental base right now is completely and totally in the cult, drinking the Kool-Aid. They're adding their own cyanide to it. I mean, that's how crazy they are. Conventions have long been the kind of the extreme of the dominated by the kind of the crazies of the party and the party leaders. You know, when I ran the party, we were always concerned about how things would play to the convention delegates because nominations. And for those listening outside of Michigan, and many in Michigan don't know that many statewide nominees, the nominee for attorney general, for secretary of state, for lieutenant governor, are selected by convention delegates and not primary election. So there's about, in the Republican Party, there's about 2,000 people who will meet next August to select the nominees for attorney general and secretary of state. And Donald Trump's endorsements virtually guarantees that those candidates will be batshit crazier than just about anybody else. And no matter what any sane, if you want to ascribe some sanity to Michigan Republican Party Chairman Ron Weiser and some of the inside players and some of the big deep pockets in the party who recognize the toxic effect that nominees like DiPerno and Caramo will have on their chances to win those seats, they're powerless to do anything about it because the genie's out of the bottle. They don't control those convention delegates. You know, I've heard Ron Weiser is telling people that that the party will not invest a dime if DiPerno is the nominee, if the convention selects DiPerno. They want Tom Leonard, who lost to Dana Nessel by a narrow 3-point margin in 2018, former Speaker of the House, considered much more of a normal candidate, put it that way. But in order to get nominated, no one who's normal is going to get through a convention. They're going to have to ascribe to the big lie that the election was stolen, that Joe Biden's an illegitimate president, and any other of the batshit conspiracy stuff that's going on.
The Republicans have taken a page out of the Democratic Party playbook, and they're doing an endorsement convention next spring. We found that advantageous in our party. We started when I was chair, because it gave candidates kind of a head start and some assurance that they were going to be the eventual nominee so they could fundraise and the like. Do you think that new endorsement convention makes any difference in your analysis?
None whatsoever. I mean, it again will be populated by these same convention delegates who have lost their fucking minds. Let's be honest here. I mean, there's no other way to say it. They're the ones who are demanding that people get COVID and that Joe Biden's an illegitimate president and the election is going to be somehow decertified somewhere along the way. They actually believe insanity like that. And so the fact that, you know, somebody like DiPerno, who is crazier or as crazy as people like Sidney Powell and Lynn Wood and Rudy Giuliani, he's standing alongside people like Mike Lindell in Antrim County, the My Pillow guy, Pillows McCrackpipe or whatever he goes by these days. That's who is going to be the standard bearer for the Michigan Republican Party. And what I was saying is I hear that Ron Weiser is telling people that, I mean, he was apparently livid that Trump, did these endorsements, especially DiPerno, who they feel is just a lost cause in November. And Trump or Weiser is telling people that Ron Weiser controls who gets nominated in Michigan, not Donald Trump. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know that that's not the case, that Donald Trump has a little more schwack than Ron Weiser, no matter what Ron might think. And so if Ron wants to make this a battle of Ron Weiser and Tom Leonard on one side versus Donald Trump and Matt DiPerno on the other, I know where my money's going, and I know where anybody who's looking to bet should place their money, and that's on DiPerno being the nominee.
Well, we learned recently that there was a time when Weiser could control the conventions as he bribed Stan Grott out of the race in 2018. But I think you're right. Those days are past. Could you envision Trump maybe even showing up at one or both of these Republican conventions next spring, Jeff?
I doubt that he would, but certainly some of his, Don Jr., people like that might. But you raised a good point. The fact that Weiser was caught bribing a candidate, Stan Grott, to get out of the race in 2018 does not preclude him from doing it again. He got a slap on the wrist. He didn't face any charges. He had to pay a $200,000 fine, which is change in the couch cushions. Let's be honest about it. And so, I think the question that all reporters in Michigan and nationally who are watching this race need to ask Matt DiPerno is, will you commit to not taking money from Ron Weiser to get out of the race? Because I assume Matt DiPerno is like everybody else and has a price point. Ron Weiser has proven to be transactional in this very, very nomination process. And so I think that is a legitimate question to put on the table is, will Matt DiPerno commit to not taking bribe money to get out of the race? That's the only thing that I think would slow his nomination is if Ron Weiser puts enough money on the table, because there's no deterrent for him doing it. If the only deterrent is perhaps a fine somewhere down the road, why would he not do it again? If they feel that is the difference between winning and losing next November.
Right, right. He may even find a way to more skillfully do it than he did last time. It was pretty ham-handed in terms of what came out after the fact, and that's what led to the fine. But you raise another good point, Jeff, in terms of, touching on what's been going on nationally with the lawyers and everything else like that, because this week we had the Eastman memo, now infamous, come out. A written plan at the highest level of the Trump administration, a script, basically, for how they expected Vice President Mike Pence to basically hijack the election in his ceremonial role overseeing the counting of the electoral votes. Most extraordinary thing I think anybody's ever seen.
It would be in normal times, but because we live in this age of unbridled dipshittery, it barely gets notice. It got a New York Times front page story, but below the fold, and it got a little bit of mention on Twitter and some cable news, but most of the country is unaware. This wasn't a campaign being thorough and planning for a close election and, making sure they had their ducks in a row and, their lawyers ready to go combat, to litigate in key states. We've been through close elections. We know, the legitimate use of the law and the system. This was a plan to deliberately chum the waters with disinformation, to use the powers of the presidency and the Department of Justice to manipulate the outcome of elections, to force or cajole and leverage states to change the outcome of elections in Trump's favor. It was a plan. It was a coup. It was a written plan for a coup for the president to stay in power, even though they knew he had lost the election. And it needs to be called for what it is. And there's this, I don't know, there's this, this, I don't, this tendency in Americans in the way that even the media covers this, to not want to ascribe the worst motives, the worst name to what it was, but unless we do, we face it happening again, and it is happening again. They've not slowed. They've only intensified their efforts to be successful next time where they were unsuccessful last time.
Right. I mean, this to me is akin to, you know, the Watergate tapes of Nixon in terms of revelations that come out like this. But this was in writing, like you said, trying to overturn the results of the election. We also saw within the last just 24 hours as we're recording here, this revelation of this memo inside the Trump campaign, where the staff acknowledged that there was no problem with the Dominion voting system. But notwithstanding knowing that, they sent their lawyers out in these Kraken lawsuits, you know, with all these conspiracy theories about Antifa controls it, or, you know, there was ties to Venezuela and Hugo Chavez and all this other nonsense. The campaign knew it before they sent these lawyers out and continued the disinformation campaign that you described, and yet they did it anyway. And this evidence now is coming out in the course of the defamation lawsuit that Dominion is pursuing against all of these characters who, you know, basically have wrecked that company in terms of its reputation by making these false allegations. I mean, again, here we are months and months after the election, and all of this continues to come out. Like you said, Jeff, any one of these should be a major story, but it's almost like we've become numb to all of this bad news and attempts to undermine the election last year.
You summed it up so well, and I think this is that will be a great topic of discussion with our guest Tom Nichols later, because that's really one of the main focus of his recent book, Our Own Worst Enemy, where we can blame the people who are manipulating the process in the masses, and you know, whether it's the propagandized media, whether it's these campaign operatives and lawyers who knew they were deliberately using the power of propaganda to create this false narrative, to get these masses mobilized behind this deliberate effort to obfuscate the fact, the simple math that Joe Biden won and won big when it counted. And so, but you can only blame at some point you have to ascribe some kind of level of personal responsibility to the tens of millions of people who are saying, yeah, you know, this Joe, I saw a poll this week that said something like 76% of Republicans believe that Joe Biden really lost the election. 76%, three quarters. It's literally insane. It's like a parallel universe that we're living alongside each other in alternate realities. There's more of us than there are of them. They think they're complete. They don't understand. It's not that they think, okay, we know we're wrong, but we're going to, you know, try to use this to strong arm our way back into power. They believe it. They believe it's reality. They believe that up is down and red is white. They just don't. You can't have rational policy making. You can't have rational conversations about this. It's not like we have we don't have political disagreements in this country. We have existential warfare about reality. We can't just, like, you know, talk about, you know, rural broadband policy one day and, you know, oh yeah, we think that you're these baby eating socialists who are, you know, have stolen our country, but, you know, let's all get along.
Right. Our damn policy just said, well, let's turn our attention, Jeff, to what we hope is a solution to at least one of our structural problems, and that's Michigan's new Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, which is attempting to draw maps which are fairer than what we've seen in the past. They have produced a couple of complete state Senate maps. And as we talk, they are attempting to draft a congressional map. You want to share your assessment of their work so far?
Well, Mark, as you know well, the plans that I was very instrumental in drawing 10 years ago, back in 2019, were ruled by a panel of three federal judges to have been politically gerrymandered, intentionally manipulated to favor the Republican Party. I would have been embarrassed 10 years ago to introduce plans as gerrymandered, intentionally or not, as the ones that the commission has produced so far. They are worse in terms of how they favor Republicans than any plan that I drew 10 years ago. In fact, I drew plans 10 years ago that kind of went to the extreme, and we looked at them and said, we can't go that far. We're going to get called on that. We stuck it in a bottom drawer and never let it see the light of day. That's how bad the congressional plan is. I mean, that it gives Republicans a virtual lock on 9 of Michigan's 13 congressional seats when, you know, they're losing statewide elections. And I know, you know, I don't want to get into the battle of proportionality, but there needs to be a fair plan in Michigan should give, right now, I would say, give either party a relatively equal chance of winning more seats than the other party. Not guaranteeing one party a supermajority. That's insane and absurd, but that's where this process has led. I don't think that's where it's going to end up. I don't think that these are the plans, but they've wasted a month that they don't have doing this. It's been a awful, flawed process so far that I hope they fix.
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree with your assessment. And I think the problem, there are a couple problems. One, they were told early on, they can't consider partisanship at this stage. So what's going on is exactly as you described, Jeff, because they have not been analyzing partisanship as they went along. They also seem to be drawing districts using whole cities, counties, and townships. And as you and I both know from having worked on redistricting in Michigan for decades, if you draw districts that way, that tends to favor the Republicans. And that's not the way to produce a fair plan. But again, I think those two are the big factors that have put them into the partisan corner that they now find themselves. And we haven't even seen a draft state house map yet. But if they follow the same process, they're probably going to have the same result. I see that they've set aside a week later this month, I believe, to assess partisan fairness. They may be in for a big surprise and face a lot of reworking of their maps once they hear the partisan analysis.
Well, it'll be not just reworking, it'll be wholesale revision. It'll be start from scratch. I mean, that's how bad a job they've done this. It's not just tinkering around the edges to fix. They've gone completely ass backwards into the process. They've ignored the constitutional criteria, the preeminent one being after, you know, one man, one vote, that the Voting Rights Act preservation of minority voting interests be considered. That was an afterthought in the process. No matter what it was the last thing they did in the Senate map. They failed to even meet the basic requirements in their congressional map. And so they've placed other concerns, ahead of what the Constitution says that they must. Not that, you know, it's nice if they do, but, you know, shall means shall, must means must.
Yeah, there's even a district in the Senate map which is way beyond the population standards, you know, just that kind of fundamental error. You know, they've been told repeatedly by their Voting Rights Act expert that they've got to unpack districts. That's going to be a real problem when they get to the state house, because we have some severely racially packed state house districts in Detroit. And I hope that they will learn some lessons from the process so far and make big improvements quickly.
Yeah. But the only ones I can tell you, the only ones who are happy about the plan so far are the Republicans, who can't believe their good luck at how this commission that they fought so hard against has, how strongly they have favored Republican interests.
Mark and Jeff are joined by Dr. Tom Nichols after these messages.
Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly 4 decades of experience accurately measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and other federal, state, and local issues. Epic MRA is one of the most quoted polling firms in the country. Clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, state agencies, local governments, labor unions, interest groups, and businesses throughout Michigan. Whether it's measuring voter opinion about who's up or down in elections, or if ballot proposals or legislation can earn voter approval, Epic MRA is known as the go-to Michigan pollster. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at The Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Tom Nichols is the author of the newly published bestseller, Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. His previous 7 books include The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, published in 2017. It's a study of why people mistrust established knowledge and how this damages democratic stability, a title even more relevant 4 years later.
Nichols is an academic specialist on international affairs, currently a professor at the U.S. Naval War College and at the Harvard Extension School. His work deals with issues involving Russia, nuclear weapons, and national security affairs. He was previously a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, and the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University.
Nichols describes himself as a never-Trump conservative and a former Republican. During the 2016 presidential campaign, Nichols argued that conservatives should vote for Hillary Clinton, whom he detested, because Trump was too mentally unstable to serve as commander-in-chief. Nichols continued that argument for the 2018 midterm elections.
Tom Nichols is a brother in the battle against autocrats and illiberalism and a Republican Party that's lurching toward both. He's also a 1970s music aficionado. Tom, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. Good to be with you guys.
Well, Tom is the author of a new book called Our Own Worst Enemy, subtitled The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. And Tom, I mean, I think the subject is fascinating. It's certainly a discussion that we have on this podcast every week, and I know many are having around the country is, you know, what the fuck is going on with this mass insanity in the country? How do you explain it, and who's to blame?
Well, you know, it didn't start 2 years ago, and it didn't start 5 years ago. The foundation for all this has been growing for a good 40 years or so. And the foundation for all this is narcissism. We have an incredibly narcissistic, affluent, bored middle class that has lost its way. And I think that's happened in the United States. It's happened in Italy, the UK, Poland, Turkey, a lot of places. But I think you see this start to take root in the early 1970s, and then it kind of picks up steam after the end of the Cold War, where we just kind of lose a sense of seriousness about everything, and we become more and more about ourselves and less about our duty as citizens, what it's like to even be a citizen. You know, I was watching a clip the other day. Of course, I live up here in New England, and there was an ad for the Kennedy Library and John F. Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And I, every time I see it, I think any president who said that today would be booed off the stage. The idea of, you know, think about what you can do for your country, and people would lose their minds if a president said that. Instead of saying, here's what I'm going to do for you. Here's what you deserve. Here's why, you know, you've been screwed and I'm going to fix it and I'm going to help you out. And while this is these days heavily concentrated in the kind of white middle class, there's a horseshoe effect going on. There's a lot of political movements that are affected by this. And I think the proof of that is that you can't really tell the far right from the far left anymore in a lot of countries, including our own.
Tom, I think you're right in terms of there's really been a loss of sense of mutual obligation to each other as citizens, right? I mean, it seems to me that decades ago, a call to everybody to be vaccinated, right? Everybody would have said, of course, that's our duty as citizens. I remember getting, you know, the sock vaccine when I was a little boy. Everybody, you know, did their duty. And there have been other many other times in our history where there's been that call to duty and people did it for each other. But yeah, I think you're right. We are really missing that now. And it's having a very pernicious effect, not just in politics, but I think across society generally.
Yeah, because politics has become not about how we live together, create a good society, you know, keep the potholes filled, take care of the poor, defend the country. Politics isn't about that anymore. Politics is about how do I feel about me? What makes me feel good about being me? Does that mean I wave, you know, blue Trump flags? Does that mean I scream about defunding the police? And I'm not going to both sides of this too heavily. I mean, there is a problem across the political spectrum, but the problem now is concentrated almost entirely, I would say, not entirely, but very heavily on middle-aged, middle-class white people. And I think that's in part, you know, this is something that the philosopher Eric Hoffer warned us about 70 years ago. He said, you know, when you've got a society where boredom is rampant, and people are, you know, reasonably well off, but that boredom becomes the defining characteristic of society, you're ripe for an authoritarian mass movement because people want to have meaning in their lives. And you're seeing that now. You're seeing people say, I have to have a crusade, whether it's, you know, stopping pedophiles or rooting out Venezuelan voting machines or, you know, believing in insane rigged election theories. I have to be important. I have to be someone. I have to have a cause. And that's making us literally, I think we have reached a point in this country with mass psychosis. We've become, you know, there's tens of millions of Americans have become, you know, functional on a day-to-day basis, but believing stuff that is completely, you know, batshit bonkers.
I've described this as, I mean, they're living in this, like feedback loop of alternate dumbfuckery, where they have this sense of reality that's completely different. They view them, the Republicans and the masses, that there are tens of millions, they view themselves as the barrier against the socialist baby eating barbarians who've stolen the election. And 76% of them in a recent study said Joe Biden's, you know, not a legitimately elected president. And they believe this stuff and they think that even though there's more of us, they think that we're completely wrong and just as crazy. And neither one, they can't coexist. This isn't about finding common ground. This is about strangling this insanity out of the country, or we're going to implode. I mean, there's just no other way around it.
I think they've reached the point where I'm not sure whether they believe it or if they've just decided they have to believe it. Because if they don't believe it, there's two things. First off, if they don't believe that, you know, elections were rigged and that there are, you know, baby eating, you know, socialists. And again, words that most of them can't even define, you know, socialists and communists running loose among us. Then they are faced with the kind of ordinariness of their lives, which is how everybody lives, right? I mean, we all have to get up in the morning and brush our teeth and go do a job that we're not crazy about and come home and make dinner and walk the dog. And I think for millions of people, that's simply not enough anymore, that they have to believe they're part of some big, important action movie or drama of the week. We have become drama queen rage addicts because that gives our lives meaning, because that makes us feel like we're somebody, like we're doing something. I think the other problem is if they stop believing it, they're going to have to suddenly confront the cognitive dissonance problem of, holy shit, I was conned, and I was conned big time. And I'm, you know, I mean, think about it, guys. If they back down now, if they say, you know, I bought it, then man, I am just the dumbest mark who ever walked the earth. And they're just not going to say that. And I think arguing with them about it has become pointless. I think they need to just kind of, what's that line from The West Wing? You're wrong. Just stand there in your wrongness and be wrong. And the rest of us need to just move on and get on with life. And that includes, you know, you're talking about masks. You know, there was a just before we came on this morning, I was reading an article in the Post about a couple who have an immunocompromised baby, and they decided they left the baby home. They decided to go out and get some food and a few beers with some friends. And they wore masks on the advice of their doctors, so they can, they're fine, they're vaccinated, but they did it. And this restaurant in Texas kicked them out because they wore masks. You know, at that point, you really are talking about people who are just, again, bonkers, batshit, full goose, bozo, crazy. And you're not going to, so you know that, God bless them, that couple should just go home, say, okay, you know, never eating there again, move on. Find some other place to go eat. It's a free country. People want to destroy their businesses doing that. That's up to them. But arguing about it and trying to talk to these folks as if they are rational is, I think,
perfect. I think that's right. But I think is the problem, though, that these folks, you know, aren't going to live in isolation. They want to control the government, right? They want to impose their views on the rest of us. And so we can't just ignore that.
By force, if necessary.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the part that has to be stopped. I mean, you know, if people want to, people don't want to wear masks or get vaccinated, well, then there are laws for public safety that prevent them from messing up life for the rest of us. But a lot of these people have decided that they're, again, this cognitive dissonance and this narcissistic grievance run so deep that they're willing to be violent about it. And, you know, that's not a democracy. I mean, you cannot, this is a country that has always prided itself since our horrific Civil War, has prided itself on trying to resolve our differences peacefully. And I think, you know, this, we really have to just draw the line on this. And I think, and this is where I will send a little zinger over the transom at my friends, our new coalition partners, as I like to call them, among the Democrats, to say, you know, this is a really deadly, serious thing. And you guys had better start taking this goddamn seriously. And that means not bickering about the infrastructure bill and, you know, pissing away your opportunities here while you go on recesses while the country burns. You know, you were, millions of us voted for you and for your party on the idea that this is an existential crisis of constitutional government. So I wish you guys would goddamn well start acting like it.
Oh, the violence you talk about is a real serious problem. You know, undoubtedly you've heard about the plot to kidnap the governor here. This past week, one of our local health commissioners was run off the road by somebody who disagreed with the fact that he mandated masks in local schools. That's how much it's deteriorating into violence.
And just think about, to go back to Jeff's question at the beginning of this, why is this happening? Just think about the level of sort of personal unhappiness and grievance that must rule your life every day. Totally unrelated to politics. I mean, these are not happy people. You know, that, and these are not poor people. These are just, you know, people who have an armload of grievances. And then they tune in, you know, almost certainly are tuning into talk radio or Fox or Newsmax or, you know, crazy internet sites and getting this gigantic infusion of rage-a-hol every night, to the point where they are literally willing to endanger the life of a public official because they don't like wearing a surgical mask. How crazy is that? But it tells you about the way that millions of people are being propagandized by political entrepreneurs on radio and television to become, you know, zombies, basically. It's really interesting. I'll just say, Jeff, it's really interesting that the same people who call everybody else sheeple and you know, sleepwalkers and zombies are, in fact, the most conformist and brainwashed human beings in the country. I mean, these guys literally stare at a television, nod at Tucker Carlson or, you know, Laura Ingraham or Hannity and say, yes, master, and, you know, go out and do crazy shit.
Yeah, well, this gets into, you know, for folks listening, Tom's previous book is called The Death of Expertise. It was a bestseller, and it gets into the, you know, the what is, we're now getting our medical advice from, you know, people like Joe Rogan, you know, saying, you know, take ivermectin, and ignoring the advice of, you know, family doctors who you've had for decades who say, hey, just get the simple vaccine. And so, you know, I look at, I saw this week that Alabama, the Elections Bureau or Secretary of State, is bringing in Mike Lindell as a consultant on how to make their next election safer. I mean, as an official consultant, the MyPillow guy, that's where we are in this country. It's people, we've got in Michigan right now, we have, we're nearing the kind of the fiscal year deadline, and we have a budget battle showdown between the Republican controlled legislature and the Democratic governor. And just yesterday it was announced they have a kind of the framework of a budget deal, but the governor had to cave in to their Republican demands that they include all these language against mask mandates, against vaccination mandates in schools and hospitals, anybody receiving state funding. It's lunacy. And there's a fine, I know some of these legislators, known them for a long time. Some of them are cynically manipulating the rubes. And some of them are just fucking crazy. And they're the ones leading policy in the state. And it's really hard to separate who's who, right now.
After a point, you can't separate who's who, because this is a great time to remind, folks of the, wonderful line by Kurt Vonnegut, who says, "We are what we pretend to be. And so we must be careful what we pretend to be." Because sooner or later, you start to believe your own bullshit. That if you say it enough times, you start to internalize it and you actually start to think it's the truth. And, you know, whether you actually believe it or not becomes irrelevant, because you've kind of repeated it enough times that it becomes, you know, the truth that you live with. And your point about guys like Rogan, you know, this is part of the narcissistic culture that we live in. My doctor is a nobody. He's not famous, but Joe Rogan's my pal. I listen to him all the time. If he tells me to take horse dewormer, well, God, you know, who's my doctor? My doctor, you know, like, being famous is more important than anything else. And people have these imagined relationships with people that they see in the public sphere. Well, you know, Joe told me to take ivermectin. I'm sure all of us who have worked in public life, people send us letters, you know, say, Jeff. And, you know, you just want to write back and say, what are we, girlfriends? What have we met? You know, the way that people respond to the public sphere is intensely personal and narcissistic. The idea that, you know, you don't know Joe Rogan. He's not your friend. He's not your personal advisor. Your doctor, who has been keeping your medical records and taking care of you for years, she might be the person who actually knows better about this. You know, I'm just spitballing here. But that's not how our culture works now. We have these imagined deep relationships with complete strangers that we see on television and on the internet and through our radios and satellite radio and every place else that we spend our time. And it's turned us into a nation of kind of mildly psychopathic kooks. The other problem again is, to climb down from any of this has such a high psychic price that people are not going to do it. We've spent inordinate amounts of time now talking about how do we get people to come back down, you know, climb out of this tree. And I'm here to say, I don't think it can be done. I think the best thing you can do is sort of shun and ignore folks, and maybe sometime down the road in the privacy of their own home, they'll come to realize they were wrong. But you cannot sustain the a civic environment and a democracy on constantly arguing with people about whether water is wet and whether the sky is blue and grass is green. You just can't.
There's going to be entire fields of psychology and sociology that are, you know, that emerge from these past 5 years in the study.
Absolutely.
What the hell went wrong. And I guess I'm, as we talk here, it just struck me. I wonder what if this would have been as crazy, as bad without COVID and the quarantines and the distance. And I wonder what role that will have played in this isolation, this detachment from reality, this connection with, you know, people online and on TV when we were kind of forced to separate. I wonder, you know, what role that played. I'm sure it played some. I don't blame it on that completely, but would it have happened to this extent? Would it have gotten worse after the election rather than better without it?
It's a really important point, because I think that the, you know, pandemics are stressful no matter, even for a democracy and in good times like ours was, you know, economy was in fairly good shape. I mean, you know, we're at peace. But yeah, pandemics are deeply stressful. What we couldn't have counted on was one political party and one sociopathic leader completely politicizing public health. Would we be in this situation? Probably not as bad. On the other hand, I think that Trump and his people would have found something. That it would have been protests. I mean, who knows? You know, maybe because of the pandemic and people not congregating, maybe we had fewer dangerous, you know, concentrations of people and large. I don't know. But I do think that the pandemic made people, you know, all of us. And I'm not pointing at, I'll say it for myself. I mean, you know, the pandemic made me pretty goddamn cranky, where I sort of sat around and ate pints of ice cream and stared at my television and didn't do anything, you know. But I still think that, you know, Trump was determined to overturn the election and was going to call for violence and seditious rebellion no matter what. But I think the pandemic, it definitely made it worse. It meant that more people were spending more time inside, staring at computer screens with nothing to do. So, you know, without the pandemic, a lot more of us might have just gone back to work and said, eh. You know, I think the election, you know, like a friend of mine said, well, I think there was a shadow over the election. Well, okay, fine. So, you know, shadow this, go back to work and get on with your life. But I think given the pandemic, yeah, it was a lot worse.
Jeff, a moment ago, you raised the point about, you know, when this is over, basically all the studies and things that are going to happen, all the analysis, I think that assumes that this is going to be over, right? That there's going to be some peaceful solution to this, and it is going to stop. And, you know, I think Tom makes a great case that, you know, we're not going to be able to talk these folks down. They're not going to be able to overcome their cognitive dissonance. So, you know, where is this headed? More violence? I mean, people have talked about civil war. And I hate to sound so apocalyptic, but where is this thing headed?
Well, I mean, I think you raised a good point there, Mark. I mean, I guess I'm assuming that sanity wins, but I mean, there's just, I've said on this podcast and elsewhere that I think violence is going to become more common in 2022 and 2024 in the elections. It's going to become normal. You know, I think that when this is over, I guess there's every bit as likelihood that I'm in a re-education camp somewhere. And, you know, maybe with Tom, if they win the next election, if they win in 2022, even, and learn that whatever they did during these last years worked, and to double down on it and keep doing more, it's going to make 2024 that more perilous. And, it's not hyperbole to say that we are hanging by a thread. This culture, it's not just this isn't just politics. This is the culture in, you know, our everything, the American way of life is hanging in the balance, and where we go from here is really uncertain. The fact that there are more people on the side of sanity may not matter if you take a smaller number of people and make them more extreme, radicalize them. The same people are being radicalized in the Republican Party right now, every bit in the same way that ISIS fighters are being radicalized. They're not strapping suicide vests on, but they're doing the same kind of damage to our democracy. But,
you know, you both have correctly, and we've had other guests, Tom, who've done this as well. Have called out the Democrats saying, look, you've got to pay attention to the existential crisis. This is not politics as usual. But, you know, it seems to me that other aspects of society aren't treating this as an existential crisis either. The corporate community, the business community, business as usual, religious groups. I mean, I think you can point to any part of our society, and I'm not sure that they are sensitized and alarmed as we are about where this is going.
Let me fold that into the question of where this goes and how it ends, because there is a glimmer of hope here, and that's called federalism. It's really tough to take over the United States because we were designed to be a big, fractious, multi-layered nation. I mean, you know, no matter how 2022 or 2024 goes, the state of California and the state of Massachusetts and, you know, likewise, you know, Texas or Florida, everybody's going to have their say about it and how they run their own states. I mean, I live in New England and I'm really glad for it, to be honest. So the idea that somehow, you know, this could turn into, you know, the Soviet Union tomorrow. I mean, that this fear that the people on the right have of, oh, it's going to be, you know, mass socialist cut, you know, that's a nice way of saying you flunked civics. But also, you know, we've already seen it. I mean, we have multiple layers of the judiciary. We have states and, you know, state and federal structures that it's pretty hard to just do this, especially when you're led by, you know, a disorganized dumb shit sociopath like Trump. Now, with that said, I agree with you guys about the potential for more violence. I think this is creating another McVeigh somewhere, you know, these sort of angry, lost young guys who somehow think they're embarked on a big crusade because they just have no clue about how manipulated they are and what they believe. But the other thing that's going to bring this to an end is just demography. Look, this is mostly an old guy movement. Yes, there are young males in it, but the most illiberal people in America, the most anti-democratic people in America, are already in late middle age. You know, the average Fox viewer is 68 years old. I mean, you know, they're not replenishing that demo as as Fox viewers, or as kind of angry old guys waving their Social Security checks in the air. You know, the generations coming up behind them are, you know, they're mostly sensible people. They're okay. The kids are all right. And I think the real question is, can we navigate the next 10 years or so, you know, through this very dark tunnel without all of these kooks burning everything down so that we are, and something we rarely talk about, that leaves us at the mercy of foreign powers, you know, where we simply are incapable of being economically or militarily competitive because we've spent so much time torching our own house.
Yeah, and here we stand as we talk. You know, we're on the brink of war with France unexpectedly. So,
well, you know, not the most artful diplomacy from the Biden administration, but I'm going to say that I think the French are reacting a tad hyperbolically, recalling ambassadors and stuff. But, you know, those are I long for the days when we have normal crises, like we didn't tell our partners that we're building submarines somewhere else and they're pissed at us. That if that's the worst problem we have all day, that would show you that we're back to being a normal country.
Well, Tom, we want to be respectful of your time, and we want to thank you for joining us this morning for this discussion. Urge people to order and read Tom's book, Our Own Worst Enemy. Please do yourself the favor. And also tune into Tom's Twitter on Saturdays around noon as he live tweets America's Top 40. It's always entertaining. It's something I look forward to. It's become part of my weekends.
What a strange strange little coffee klatch that's become. We don't even do it officially. I started doing this with a guy who's a Grammy-winning producer out in L.A., and we just started shooting the breeze about dumb 70s stuff. And we also do it because we love listening to the late Casey Kasem tell us that Elton John's from England, you know. And it's just such a great throwback to an innocent time. You know, four guys who call themselves The Who. So we just every now and then we just take that little trip down memory lane. So.
Well, Tom, thank you very much. We will hold to federalism and to demography over the next decade. That's the first good news I've heard in several weeks about
I hope I'm right.
I hope you are too. I really do. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Mark.
Clear from your, Tom, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. And before you go, Maddie wanted me to say hi. She's, you know, I'm married to your number one fan girl. So
send her my regards.
Will do.
All right. Take care, guys.
That's our time for this week. Our great thanks to Tom Nichols for joining the discussion.
Let us know what you think. Email us at comments@arepublicpodcast.com. And don't forget to check out our merch center. Just go to arepublicpodcast.com and click on the merch store button. Ben Franklin would appreciate it.
If the Republic is still standing, we'll be back in a week. I'm Mark Brewer.
And I'm Jeff Timmer. Thanks for giving us your time.
You can subscribe to A Republic If You Can Keep It on your favorite podcast app. A Republic If You Can Keep It is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.